It is always this utopian idea of an America tranquil and routine that gets paraded out when an angry soul with a personal mission of hatred shows up somewhere and starts shooting, as James Hodgkinson did yesterday in Alexandria, Virginia, showing up at a baseball field to kill members of Congress practicing for a charity game. Or was it just a particular congressman, Steve Scalise, who was targeted? Scalise was injured. We'll never know now. Hodgkinson is dead and Scalise is in critical condition. Unrelated, but part of America's violence landscape, a gunman also showed up in a UPS facility in San Francisco, killing three people yesterday and injuring six before turning the gun on himself. Was Hodgkinson some radicalized Senator Bernie Sanders ideologue assailing Republican lawmakers for favoring the super rich? He was a Sanders volunteer, we know that. A friend of Hodgkinson described him as not evil, but simply fed up with the political situation. Anything else we can know here? Anything else that would be useful? Kirsten Stewart joins us now, policy director at Futures Without Violence, a nonprofit organization focused on ending violence against women and children domestically and abroad. Kirsten, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
There's a lot we can know about anyone. We all have complicated biographies, and among the biographical details of James Hodgkinson was that he had a history of domestic violence, right?
That's correct.
And how important do you think that is, given that, you know, a lot of the media is focusing on his political orientation and his, you know, anger at Republicans?
We do think domestic violence is an important precursor and indicator of future violence. We think the focus on political ideology right now really misses the broader point, both of this is a man who has a long history, it appears, of violence. And had that violence been taken more seriously, perhaps he wouldn't have access to the guns and done the damage that he did yesterday. What the reporting does show is, you know, more than 10 years ago, this is a man who had multiple cases of violence against women in particular. That's what I'm most familiar with, both personal people, seemingly girlfriends, other women in his community. His daughter seemed to bear a brunt of a significant portion of the violence, at least that was what was reported, and that those who tried to protect her, I mean, this is a man who went into a car, according to some accounts,
right,
you know, took a knife and ripped open the seatbelt to try to get at somebody. So this is, again, now more than 10 years ago, a history of violent behavior. We don't know what happened in those intervening 10 years. You know, there are laws that say if you perpetrate and have a conviction for domestic violence, you cannot purchase or possess a gun.
Where are places that take that seriously?
So now, you know, it is a little tricky, right? As we know, there are some loopholes. But we do know that in some of the states where we do see stricter enforcement of gun retrieval laws, you actually have lower intimate partner homicide. One of the strategies that we've developed recently due to research from Dr. Jacqueline Campbell, actually up at Johns Hopkins University, is what we call a dangerous assessment or a lethality assessment. There are some things that we know that seem to suggest somebody's more dangerous than other things. So certainly one is a history of domestic violence. That is still the best predictor of whether someone's going to use violence is if they've already used violence before. Access to firearms is another indicator. Someone who has a history, for instance, of strangulation is a real indicator of increased dangerousness. Someone who's lost a job or unemployed. Again, there are these factors. There's about 10 of them that we look at when we think about how dangerous someone is in a domestic violence situation for homicide. And we think that it's worth looking at the research and considering some of those measures when we look across other types of violence as well. We don't have the definitive research that says, you know, if there are these eight things, this is a person who's going to, you know, go commit a mass shooting. I don't think we're ever going to quite get to that. But we can say, here are some things that we know increase risk, and here are some things that we know reduce risk. Let's support the policies, attitudes, and behaviors that reduce risk. And one of those things is keeping guns from people who we know have a history of violence.
Possibly the only policy that's going to work is to embrace people who are known to have violent problems and encourage them to get counseling and make counseling something that's not stigmatized and have a more responsible attitude about mental health, just generally speaking. And we don't have that in the United States.
That's absolutely right. And I do think it's important that we're having this conversation in the context of healthcare reform. You know, we are a week away from potentially taking healthcare away from 23 million Americans, many of them the most vulnerable, many of them who are in low-income situations, in vulnerable situations, specifically because of past histories of violence and trauma that may make it harder for them to get or keep a job or have a job that pays, you know, includes health insurance. So I think I really want to support what you're saying, which is that it is both about, you know, guns are certainly one part of the equation, but building healthy, strong families and communities is another equally, if not more important part of the conversation. We know most mental health issues begin in adolescence, and we know that it's incredibly important that we recognize trauma in children, that children who are exposed to violence in childhood, experience trauma in childhood and youth, are those who are also much more likely to struggle as adults. They're more like, you know, less likely to graduate from school, more likely to get in trouble with the law, and that often can create a cascading violence cycle. We believe that the emphasis on intervening early and often is where we should be focusing our policies and our funding, that we need to, you know, prevent violence, prevent trauma, and where it does exist, to intervene as early as possible.
Kirsten Sturt is Policy Director at Futures Without Violence. It's a nonprofit organization based in San Francisco focused on ending violence against women and children domestically and abroad. She spoke with us from Washington, D.C. Thanks so much, Kirsten.
Thank you.